strong trustees were more important than staff and money, and has certainly been the case with Attorney General Brownell and the Miller Center of Public Affairs. Historians and Chief Justices of the Supreme Court rarely agree on anything, but on one thing they do agree. The historian Stephen Ambrose, who sometimes is critical of the Eisenhower administration, and Chief Justice Berger both have recently made the comment that Herbert Brownell is the greatest attorney general of the 20th century, and some go even beyond that period. He was chairman of the Republican Party from 44 to 46. He gave leadership in the management of Thomas Dewey's two presidential campaigns, and he also led President Eisenhower's campaign before becoming Attorney General. So he speaks from a wide background of experience in the political field. He has contributed to our Eisenhower oral history, and we thought it was entirely appropriate, therefore, that as we entered this other field, whereas one of you at this table has said studying presidential candidates who didn't make it may teach us more than studying those who did. And we have had two of these discussions. We look forward to having more, but certainly a high point in our inquiry into this particular aspect of the presidency is our discussion this morning. It's a great privilege to introduce Attorney General Brownell.
Thank you, Ken. When I was a youngster, I used to listen to Civil War veterans tell about their battles 50 years before, and I looked on them with considerable wonderment, as though they were creatures from another planet. And I imagine you have that sort of the same reaction this morning when I start talking about the political battles that took place 50 years ago. Indeed, it was 60 years ago when I first met Tom Dewey. We were both transplanted New West and Middle Westerners who went to New York and joined in the fight to political fight to throw out Jimmy Walker and the Tammany Hall. And I was the one selected to run for the legislature to sponsor the investigation, and my campaign manager was Thomas E. Dewey. And you can see the association goes back a long way. I have an impossible assignment from Ken this morning to try and summarize two presidential elections of the Dewey years in 20 minutes. So I personally look forward to the question and answer period more than I do talking about these campaigns. But they do have some aspects which are interesting even today. I first managed Dewey's campaign for governor in 1942, and that was no sooner was Dewey elected and installed in the governor's seat in Albany than the press began talking about him as a very likely candidate for president in 1944. And some of the political leaders in the Republican Party from around the country came flocking into Albany to take a look at this youngster, Dewey, to see how he would fit into the national picture. And Dewey was busy with his legislative program and picking his cabinet, so he asked me to see some of these visitors who came in from around the country to look him over. And before I knew it, I became involved in Republican politics on a national basis. And by 1943, Dewey was well ahead in the polls as in the candidacy for Republican nomination for president. And he chose a triumvirate of people, Russell Sprague and Ed Jekyll and myself, to manage his political fortunes in 1944. Jekyll and Sprague were very experienced Republican leaders with many contacts throughout the country, and they had revived the Republican Party in New York State from the long drought during the New Deal years, and transferred the leadership of the party in that state from the rural counties to the metropolitan areas to reflect the change in population pattern there. Dewey couldn't really afford to have either one of these men as his political manager because in a way they were rivals. So I got along with both of the men, and that's the way we came to be a triumvirate and two strong party bosses, and myself were the triumvirate that entered in to the 44 presidential campaign. You will, of course, recall that World War II was in full swing at that time, so local politics or domestic politics was at a low pitch. My first problem was how to build a Dewey-oriented team to get the nomination. Dewey had run for president in 1940. That's before I came on the scene. I wasn't part of that campaign, but some of the people that supported him in that first time were isolationists, and they did not approve of Dewey's becoming an internationalist, which he quickly did in view of the international situation. Two of the ablest people were Ruth Hanna McCormick Sims, the old Hanna family, and the old, McCormick family at Chicago Tribune. They were isolationists, and they were excellent organizers, and I tried to bring them into this first campaign, but they were quite disturbed about Dewey's becoming an internationalist. His chief advisors were, for his speech writing, were John Foster Dulles, who later, of course, became Secretary of State, and a man by the name of Elliot Bell, who was, some of you knew, from the McGraw-Hill publications, where he was a business editor. And they were both strong internationalists, and so I had this, during this 44 campaign, during the wartime, had to try and work both with internationalist followers of Dewey and the old group of isolationists, and it was quite a trick. Dewey and Wilkie and Senator Vandenberg of Michigan were trying to push the Republican Party into an internationalist point of view, and they had a conference at Mackinac Island. Some of you might even remember that. And on the other flank of the Republican Party was Senator Bob Taft and John Bricker from Ohio, who represented the isolationist point of view. And Dewey was reluctant at first to get into the 44 fight because he was new governor of the state and really immersed in its problems. But he was the favorite in the polls, and by the time the National Convention of the Republican Party met in Chicago, Dewey was clearly the favorite, and he was nominated. And he asked me to sound out Governor Bricker of Ohio on accepting the vice presidential nomination, and that was the team. I had myself had favored Governor Dwight Green of Illinois for the vice presidential nomination, and we had it all arranged for him to swing the Illinois delegation to Dewey and make an internationalist speech. But he submitted his acceptance or his keynote speech to Colonel McCormick of the Chicago Tribune, and the final draft of the speech which he delivered was strongly isolationist, so he was no longer considered for the vice presidency. And then Dewey asked me to become national chairman, which I did. But as I say, the nation was poised for a wartime election campaign, and its interest was really primarily on the battlefields of Europe rather than domestic politics. Well, to get into the 44 campaign in that framework, the plight of the farmers was the major domestic issue. And Dewey turned to the agricultural experts in Cornell University at Ithaca for his advice on agricultural matters, and this raised the hackles of the Middle Western farmers, who thought that he was representing the consumers rather than the producers. And they were very suspicious of Dewey on that score. So I persuaded Governor McKelvey of Nebraska. I came from Nebraska, and I used to deliver papers to his house when he was governor. I persuaded him to be the Middle West campaign manager for Dewey, and to get over this suspicion that the farmers had of this Eastern candidate. Well, he was, of course, an expert in that field, and among other things, he arranged a rodeo at his Sandhill ranch and invited Dewey as the guest of honor to meet all the Republican leaders from the Middle West. The minute the party, the railroad special train, landed at McKelvey's ranch, disaster struck because the candidate got off wearing a Homburg. And instead of going direct to the grandstand, he went to the hotel, put some finishing touches on his speech, and he got to the rodeo late, still wearing his Homburg. And instead of the big cheer we expected, he got booed. Back at the New York headquarters, I must say, I received this news with real dismay, and a splendid speech on the farm issue was completely overlooked by the crowd. Well, in the middle of the campaign, President Roosevelt made a trip to a wartime trip to the Pacific, which he billed as a non-political trip. But it was quite obviously a campaign ploy. And he reported on his return to the West Coast from a naval station in Bremerton, Washington, on the progress of the war. And so I, as a neophyte manager, demanded equal time for my candidate. After a very tough fight with the networks, they turned it down. But I do think I'm right in saying that the fight that we had then did result 4 years later in acceptance by the networks of equal time for both candidates. But we couldn't get it that year. Well, another managerial chore was to try and bring Wendell Willkie into line. He didn't like didn't like Dewey at all. But his, of course, his support was very important for us. I couldn't solve the problem. I appealed to Harry Luce, who was the publisher of Time Life magazines, to get us together. So the three of us met in Luce's apartment in the Waldorf Hotel, and I made my little speech to Willkie. But he really was rather bitter about Dewey, and he denounced him all over the lot. Suddenly he said, I want you to know, Brownell, that Dewey's going to be defeated, and I'm going to be the candidate in 4 years from now, 1948, and I'll be elected. But he said, I like you, Brownell. I would like to have you as my campaign manager. So that gave me my opening, and I told him I couldn't be in two camps at the same time. But there was one thing that was clear, and that was that if he was going to be the candidate of the Republican Party in 1948, he had to support the Republican candidate for president in 1944. And he finally agreed to that reluctantly, and right from the Waldorf, he called Gene Pulliam, who was a publisher out in Indiana, He was the grandfather of Vice President Quayle, by the way, and arranged for him to, he owned a lot of radio stations, for him to set up a network at which time he was to come out for Dewey for president. But unfortunately, when the time for the broadcast arrived, I went to his funeral instead of to listen to his broadcast, and he never did make that speech. I suppose the chief crisis in the campaign, at least from my point of view, as to whether or not we should make a an issue of the failing health of FDR. The pictures at that time of the president showed that he was an ill man and a very tired man. And in fact, due to the research by Ken Crispell and others, it turned out that the president at this time had hypertensive heart disease, hardening of the arteries, and acute bronchitis. And no investigation that was made by friendly Congress. He had a friendly Congress at that time, and there was no investigative reporting by the press on the subject of his health. But his doctors did make a statement that he was constitutionally sound. That, I think, is as far as they would go. Well, my publicity manager was a fellow by the name of Steve Hannigan, who was a very likable and important press relations expert. And he prepared a very elaborate document for Governor Dewey's consideration, making the president's failing health a major campaign issue. And Dewey's advisors were split down the line. But to make a long story short, Dewey decided that he could not, in the view of the wartime situation and the statement by the president's doctors, that he couldn't make a convincing case. And he did not use it, and my campaign, my press relations man, Steve Hannigan, resigned in the middle of the campaign. Well, of course, the end of that story is well known. When Roosevelt was reelected and on Inauguration Day, he suffered severe chest pains, and unknown to the public that was, and on April 12th he died, and Harry Truman became president. Well, it's interesting to note that that decision by Dewey not to make the president's health an issue was the contrary result was reached some years later by Adlai Stevenson when he was campaigning against Eisenhower, and he made Eisenhower's health an important campaign issue. So take your choice as to which is the right one politically or from the standpoint of the enduring policy of our country. That was also the campaign in which the political action committees were first used, which is interesting in the light of today's situation. There was a fellow named Sidney Hillman who was head of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Union, and he contributed large amounts through a PAC to Roosevelt's reelection campaign. At that time, corporate campaign contributions were prohibited by law, and we thought that the same rule should apply to labor unions, and we made a fuss about it, but we didn't succeed, and the Democratic Party received tremendous financial help from this PAC. And Hillman himself was close to Roosevelt at the Democratic convention that year. He, when some of the Democratic leaders approached him on some important problem, he said, "We'll clear it with Sidney." So we took up that battle cry, and we had lots of advertising and so forth to show the influence of this left-wing labor union leader on the New Deal campaign. But we didn't get very far with that either. But it was, for a time, a very lively subject during the campaign. Then we had the issue that as to whether or not Dewey should tour the battlefields, more or less to offset the fact that Roosevelt had gone over and on this trip to the Far East and during the midst of the campaign. But and there again, we were split down the middle as to whether Dewey should do that. He didn't have a war record of his own, and some of his advisors thought it would just show up the fact that he wasn't a war veteran. And one of his chief advisors, Ed Jekyll, whose name I mentioned at the beginning, resigned over this subject. He thought it was a great mistake for Dewey not to go to the battlefields and mix with the GIs and show his great interest in them. And then another tough one that we had was whether or not Dewey should speak out on the Pearl Harbor situation. You'll recall that that was very controversial at the time as to whether or not Roosevelt could be charged with responsibility for not averting the Pearl Harbor incident because of the fact that we did know through breaking the Japanese code that they were about to move into the South Pacific. And so there was a lot of political charges made against FDR that he should have taken those warnings and averted the disaster at Pearl Harbor. So the way it came into the campaign was that General Marshall sent one of his deputies from the Army up to see Dewey and told him that he heard that Dewey was about to make an attack on FDR for failure to avert the tragedy at Pearl Harbor. And he wanted Dewey to know that if he made such an attack, it would show to the Japanese that we had broken their wartime code. And he said the Japanese did not realize that, in his opinion, and that he was still receiving valuable military information every day from the Japanese code, and the Japanese were ignorant of the fact that we were getting that, so that if Dewey made this speech, it might result in the loss of American lives. So Dewey decided that he would not use that issue, which of course would have been a major issue if he had used it, but he decided that in the wartime atmosphere then, and his confidence in General Marshall, that he would accept Marshall's word that this was not a political ploy by the FDR forces, but rather a sincere warning against endangering national security. Dewey himself tried to maintain a bipartisan foreign policy during this campaign and not to split the country apart on support for the war. He, as I said, used John Foster Dulles as his main advisor in this foreign affairs field, but unfortunately, right in the middle of the campaign, Dulles had a big attack of gout, and he was laid up most of the time, so that was a handicap to us in the campaign. But Dewey went ahead and made several fighting speeches in spite of all these handicaps of campaigning against the commander-in-chief during the war. And he especially struck at the New Deal's failure to make preparations for a reconversion after the war and planning for to avert the dislocation of jobs that would ensue. And this sort of got Roosevelt's goat. He made some pretty strong speeches on this subject, Dewey did. And so Roosevelt, although he had said it wouldn't be necessary for him to campaign against Dewey, decided to campaign. And he made a rousing speech to the Teamsters Union. He teased the Republicans for attacking his dog, Fala. And that made a great hit and really was a devastating political speech against the Republicans. Well, Richard Nixon, of course, a few years later picked that up, and when he made his famous Checkers speech, he modeled it on the Afala speech that FDR had made to the Teamsters Union in the 44 campaign. Well, the vote finally at the end of 44 was surprisingly close. And it's interesting from the standpoint of history to note that the British election, which came just 4 or 5 months after our 44 campaign, the voters in Great Britain threw out their wartime leader, Winston Churchill. So that little gap there was terribly important in American politics. Well, so much for the 44 campaign. I mention these things to try and stimulate your questions when we get to that point and come to the 48 campaign between Truman and Dewey. I think everybody around this table would have only one recollection of that campaign, and that was a very cocky Harry Truman holding up the early edition of the Chicago Tribune on the morning after election saying, "Dewey elected," and imitating the voice of the commentator Hans Kaltenborn, who in his deep guttural voice announced to the press that Dewey had been elected. Well, Truman was entitled to celebrate. He'd confounded the pundits, and his given hell populist speeches were very appealing to the voters, and he won. The Republican story is quite different. It goes back 2 years to 1946, the mid-year elections. The Republicans, for the first and for one of the few times in modern history, did cast more votes for congressional candidates than the Democrats. There was a big swing away from the New Deal, and the Republican sweep in 46 was really impressive, but it sowed the seeds, as we later discovered, for the outcome in 1948. In the first place, it released Truman from having to slavishly follow the New Deal policies of his predecessors, and it enabled him to become the leader of his party on his own and raise his stature in the eyes of the American people. On the other hand, the Republicans Senator Taft gained great prominence by that Republican victory in 46 and became known as Mr. Republican. He opposed Truman on everything. He espoused the Taft-Hartley Act, of course, which was anathema to the labor unions, and he was basically an isolationist in public affairs. And for most people, or many people at least, especially independents, Republican and Taft were synonymous, and there was a clear ideological difference known to the public between Democrats, i.e. Truman, and the Republicans, i.e. Taft. Well, moderate Republicans like Dewey believed that Senator Taft was too conservative to be elected in 48. There were several moderate Republican candidates at that time. Senator Vandenberg, who had been converted from an isolationist to an internationalist, but he paid a political price by antagonizing his former followers, so he didn't get very far. Harold Stassen was a strong candidate. He held the loyalty of many young Republicans because of his record as governor of Minnesota, and he had beaten the New Deal in that state. Governor Earl Warren was a candidate, and in 48 he led the moderate wing of the Republican Party in California, but never got much, if any, political strength outside of his own state. And General Douglas MacArthur threw his hat in the ring, but he was badly defeated in Wisconsin and didn't become too much of a factor in the final analysis. And then Governor Dewey was the candidate from New York. He was the leading candidate in the polls because of his record as what he'd been governor of New York and for the comparatively strong showing that he had made against FDR 4 years before. So again, I found myself in the midst of national politics and traveled around the country and met the people who I thought were going to be delegates in 48, renewed my acquaintances, and went into the kitchen and dried the dishes with the wives of the prospective delegates, and got acquainted with their families and knew their local problems, and which gave me, of course, a strong position in the Republican convention that ensued. Our first problem of management was that Dewey declared that he wasn't a candidate. And he remained in Albany with his legislative program. So when I would go out and say what a fine president he would make, the answer was, well, he says he isn't a candidate. And I had to overcome that. Dewey did make some very thoughtful speeches on national issues, supporting a bipartisan foreign policy, and that threw him open to the charge by Senator Taft that he was just a Me Too candidate and it wouldn't make any difference in foreign affairs whether Truman was elected or Dewey was elected. And that was a management problem for us. But we finally persuaded Dewey to make some non-political speeches. We cooked up the idea he should go to New Hampshire because he had some ancestors that were buried there, so he went to pay his respect to his ancestors. And of course, it was also the first primary state, which managers had in mind. And then we finally got him to go out to a meeting of the governors in the West, and he was able to go around the national parks and in a non-political mode of conduct, but incidentally meet a lot of the Republican leaders along the way. So, but it wasn't until May of 1948, when the Oregon primary was approaching, that he decided to become an open candidate. So in spite of his his wife's objections, because he had a bad throat that was almost as bad as the one that I have this morning, and he finally decided to go anyway and make this the campaign in Oregon. He debated Harold Stassen there on whether or not the Communist Party should be eliminated from the ballots, whether it should be a recognized political party in the United States. And he took the position that it would be undemocratic and against our form of government to prohibit the Communists from being on the ballot. And he won that campaign against Stassen, who argued to the contrary. And the result was he carried Oregon by a sizable vote, Dewey did. And that was the turning point in the pre-convention campaign. So when the 48 election, or Republican convention opened, he was a strong favorite. And the other moderate candidates didn't make much of a show there, and I remember the convention very well, and it was in Philadelphia, and I, right in the midst of it, I had my back went out, and I had an awful sensation there that almost threw me to the floor, and I decided that my time had come, and So I went on because I thought that'd be a glorious way to die right in the midst of a Republican convention. And it turned out that Dewey was renominated, and became the Republican standard bearer. Well, we thought he would be elected, and we based our predictions not so much on the Republican strength as the Democratic weakness. Truman at that point really had some woes to contend with. He was deserted by the left wing of his party, and Henry Wallace became a independent candidate. And on the Democratic right, Strom Thurmond, who was then a Democrat, deserted the party and walked out of the convention and established a separate campaign, a separate wing of the Democratic Party on the ballot. So there were three really Democratic candidates, and we thought that with that split in the Democratic strength, that Dewey would be able to walk in. And the polls certainly showed that, and the media showed that, and the public opinion was prepared for a Dewey victory. And that was, of course, a handicap to us in the campaign because it made our workers overconfident throughout. Well, the strategy of Truman was a very clever one. It was devised by Clark Clifford. You'll remember he was later Secretary of Defense under President Lyndon Johnson. But he capitalized on the Republican weakness, which was the fact, which grew out of the fact that there was great difference between Dewey's moderate Republican position, internationalist in nature, and the Republican leaders in the Congress, who were much more conservative and were isolationist. So Truman, drawing on Clifford's outline of campaign strategy, opened his campaign by calling the Congress back into session and saying, now the Republicans have nominated Dewey, they've adopted a moderate Republican platform. Let's see now. Let's call on the Republicans in Congress to pass that moderate Republican point of view. And of course, they wouldn't do it. And Dewey immediately recognized that what Truman was doing was making the presidential campaign Truman against the Republicans in Congress, rather than a Truman-Dewey campaign. Dewey recognized the implications of this, and he sent me down to Washington to have an off-the-record meeting at the old Statler Hotel with the Republican congressional leaders, especially with Senator Taft, Mr. Republican. Well, I went with an olive branch in hand because I remembered the bitter convention fight that had ensued between Dewey and Taft. But Taft took the position that he wouldn't change any of his positions that he had publicly taken as the Senate Majority Leader. And Vandenberg took the position that this was a dirty political move by Truman to do this right in the midst of campaign and prevent the Republicans from going to their home districts and campaigning for re-election. So he was in favor of just adjourning without doing anything. So the result was that I didn't get any place. I suggested on behalf of Dewey that they pass an extension of the coverage of Social Security and a liberal immigration bill. And those were two things that Dewey supported in his platform. And that would demonstrate to the people that we had a progressive program in mind, and it would foil Truman's strategy. But it failed, and when I reported to Dewey that Taft and Vandenberg and River Combe and the other Republican leaders had turned me down, he decided that he would have the same fate if he went down himself to try to meet with them personally. So we also decided, and this was probably the biggest political decision we made during the campaign, that if we told the public that we had been turned down by the Republican leaders, it would show the Republican Party was fatally split between the two wings, and it would be a great handicap to us in the presidential campaign. So we never disclosed that meeting with the Republican leaders. And as a result, Truman picked up on it and made the failures of the 80th Congress, the Republican Congress, the issue and the focus in the campaign, and he took the initiative in away from Dewey at that point. And he turned populist in his appeals and pitted the poor against the rich and the farmers against Wall Street. And he even accused Dewey of being a front man for the same cliques that had backed Hitler and Mussolini and Tojo. And it was a really bitter campaign that he waged. Dewey, on the other hand, some of the commentators said, gave a series of high-minded inauguration speeches rather than indulging in campaign oratory. And, of course, that was the time when radio was the medium for getting across to the voters, and dramatic speeches on the radio, such as Truman delivered, really drew the attention of the electorate away from Dewey. And the Henry Wallace campaign fell apart. He embraced the Communist Party, so he was rejected by the voters. He was supposed to be the balance of power in Illinois, one of the key states, but his campaign amounted to zero at the end. And the and Thurman's campaign in the South didn't get off the ground. So the hopes we had of a split Democratic Party did not eventuate. And then Truman made a strong point by recognizing the state of Israel in the last few weeks of the campaign, and that drew him a lot of votes. But probably the decisive element in the 48 presidential campaign was the slippage of the farm vote. I had urged more prominence for Middle West farm leaders again in the campaign, but I didn't get very far, and I became so frustrated that at one point in the campaign I telegraphed my resignation as campaign manager to Tom Dewey, but I had a smart assistant named Tom Stevens, and when he saw the telegram, he tore it up, and it never reached Dewey. So I went on as the balance of the campaign, as the manager. Well, our confidential polls at the end of the campaign showed that Truman was making great progress. So I pulled the Republican National Committeeman, the state chairman, around, and as to whether or not they thought Dewey should change his tactics at the end of the campaign, because we knew Truman was sneaking up on us in the polls. And they voted 90-1 that he should maintain the tactics that he had employed up to that time, and not get down and wallow in the gutter, as some people put it, by wild charges. And turned out that those 90 people who told him to continue the same tactics were the ones after the election that attacked him for the stupid campaign that he had run. But that's human nature. And Dewey himself was quite cognizant of the fact that that Truman was gaining on him. And unnoticed by almost everybody, at the end of the campaign, Vice President Alvin Barkley stepped up his campaign. He was a very noted orator, and he went into the Middle West and he denounced the 80th Congress, the Republican Congress, for failing to appropriate funds to build government storage facilities for grain. Well, now, grain prices had dropped 50% during the campaign. The media didn't get the significance of that, but Alvin Barkley did, and he said, well, you farmers have to sell your grain at the current rock bottom prices, but if the Republican Congress had done what we wanted them to do, you'd have had government built grain storage facilities, and you could have stored that grain until the market went up again. And so I've always credited Barkley with being the winner of that campaign. He turned the tide in the three agricultural states, which Ohio and Illinois and California, which if it had been just a few thousand votes out of the millions of votes that were cast in those three states, Dewey would have been elected. And Dewey said after the campaign, "You can analyze figures from now to kingdom come, and all they will show is that we lost the farm vote, which we had won in 1944, and that lost the election." So the The battle was over, very, very close. Eisenhower won 4 years later, but the 48 campaign turned out to be a great watershed in the history of the waning of the New Deal and the ascension of the Republican Party, which has been the dominant party since 52. And Dewey took it like a stoic, and I wasn't in the room actually when I was on the TV that night as campaign manager and just saying, wait till the farm vote comes in, we're still going to win. And that was almost as famous as the Chicago Tribune headline. And the pundits took that up and teased me, still do whenever I meet any of the old reporters from the days of 48. They remember my optimism, excessive optimism, as the night wore on and with the election hanging in the balance. So I'll just close by saying that Dewey and I, after the election, went out to Arizona with our families for a little rest and recreation. And when I got back to the office, my senior partner said to me, "I'm so sorry that hear about you and Dewey." And I said, "Well, what's that?" And he said, "Well, Charlie Knickerbocker in the Hearst Press reported that on election night Dewey was so mad at you that he picked up a chair and hit you over the head." And it took me many, many years to convince my friends that that didn't happen. Such are the ways of politics.
It's a wonderful. In the Supreme Court appointment, maybe we need a few more people today who have a love of politics. Who'd like to ask the first question? Bill Wemple?
This is not really a question, but I remember that the only thing, I never got to talk politics with Governor Dewey, but he did make one comment in my presence, very cryptic. He said, "When so many people have contributed so much money, you hesitate a long time before going against the advice of your political advisors." I think you meant those 90 people you referred to.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true.
Henry Theobar?
Back in 44, I was in the Navy based in Washington, and one of the things that mystified me and others, it was so obvious at the time that Mr. Roosevelt was in very, very poor shape. And as far as in my world, it was just generally recognized he was in trouble. And then and ever since, I've thought that this decision not to use that in the campaign was really a disservice to the country.
Mm-hmm. I certainly appreciate that point of view. I have to remember it was wartime. He was our commander-in-chief. That's all that the average voter cared about, was getting that war over, and I thought that under FDR's presidency that we were winning the war. And they didn't believe stories that he was sick. And he exploited his condition very shrewdly in the final week of the campaign. He went up to New York, and it was raining, cats and dogs. He bundled himself up in the back seat of the car in a big overcoat wrapped around him. Nobody could see him except his arms waving, and you just couldn't convince anybody that he wasn't and not only the successful wartime leader, but that he was in good health. And he drove from there up to New Haven and Boston and made three speeches in which he appeared to be in good health. And it was just, I think we would have been, I think Dewey would have been considered almost a traitor if he had indicated that a fatally ill man was guiding the wartime strategy. Anyhow, that was the picture, and when you look at it as a Monday morning quarterback, as I always love to do on any issue, it looks so it was a mistake. But could we have convinced the American people against the statement by the president's doctors, and everybody in the Democratic-controlled Congress would have supported the president and pointed out instances in which decisions were being made every day on a wartime basis, and probably we never would have gotten away with an argument that he was fatally ill.
Next, Wilson Newman.
General, my inquiry has to do with the Homburg hat. And it also has to do, as I remember at that time, I was been in New York for a long time, has to do, it was projected by the media as someone similar to the little man on the wedding cake.
Yes.
Now, I mention this incident because you knew the people involved. At one time, I wanted to employ an officer of the Morgan Guarantee. I didn't think it was fair to do so without talking to Henry Alexander, who was head. And I called up Henry and said, I want to employ so-and-so, but I don't think it's fair to not let you know and to get your appraisal. He said, Wilson, he's a fine fellow, and we'll be glad for you to have him. But I think I owe it to you to tell you he's the only man I ever knew who could strut sitting down. The subject of my comment is the visual impression that people make, and that Homburg hat and the wedding cake, and now it's become so terribly important with television. Mr. Nixon had the problem in the makeup. Would you comment on that as a candidate?
It is the major factor in political campaigns now. People judge by what they see on TV. Now, at the time of the Dewey campaign, of course, there was no TV. The way that people saw their presidential candidates in those years was the Fox movie tone, which was played in every moving picture theater, and we all used to go to them in those days. And they had not the close-up shot that you get in TV today, but an intermediate shot and intermediate length between the camera and the person being photographed. And when Dewey was on the newsreels, all you could see was that mustache. He looked like a devil. And that's the way lots of people judged him, that he was a sinister figure. And that made all the difference, just as today when we, on TV, people see every line in the face of the candidate and they make up their minds whether he's a nice guy or not. And that was a big factor that I could have mentioned in more detail in the 44 and 48 campaigns. Dewey was not a strutter. He was a very intelligent fellow, and he suffered fools gladly, or did not suffer fools gladly. And people would come in. That was one of my problems as a manager. People would come in and make suggestions to him in the campaign, hopefully big donors and whatnot. And if it turned out to be a crackpot idea, which it did more than half the time, he would say so to the fellow, you know, that's a crackpot idea, you're all right. And the fellow would go out and just as mad as he could be, and our job would be to smooth that over. But Dewey was candid with everybody, and he was very open in his discussions, and he just wouldn't disguise his feelings on somebody who would come in and wasn't quite as smart as he was politically.
Dr. Kurzweil.
Refresh our memory, as you have so well. Did Taft run against Eisenhower?
Yes.
52?
Yes.
My question is, we talked about, I'm always interested in health issues. Did you know how sick Taft was?
No.
You know, he died within 6 months.
The first year, yeah.
He'd already had a diagnosis of cancer, mate, but that never came into the 52.
No. And in the first few months of the Eisenhower administration, we didn't even realize it. Eisenhower was shocked beyond belief when it was disclosed that he was dying of cancer.
Next question. Yes, Treva Cromwell.
How do you account for Mr. Dewey's initial reluctance to run in 1948?
Oh, he in 48. There were several factors that would account for it. One was he was always looking over his shoulder at Eisenhower, who was being touted by both Democrats and Republicans in 48. We forget that, and as to whether or not he would get into the race. And if he thought that if Eisenhower got into the race, he couldn't win. He thought he could beat Truman, but he didn't think he could beat Eisenhower. That was, in the light of history, an interesting situation there. And the other was, he didn't really like the campaigning. That he'd been through it in the 44 campaign, and he'd seen all the tawdry parts of political campaigning, and the bitterness that was involved. His wife didn't like politics and wanted him to get out. He felt that he had done his share by running in 44 and in campaigning on an affirmative basis, not a negative basis. So that he had some real reasons for being reluctant to get into it all over again.
Next question. Yes, Lauren Henry.
Yeah. One of the things about that 48 campaign that's often discussed is the story that Dewey was so confident of a victory that he was organizing his administration before Election Day by presumably choosing cabinet members and preparing policies and so on, and according to the political lore, at least, this was considered presumptuous and so on. Could you tell us, as a matter of fact, how much pre-election organizing and preparing for what we later began to call the transition really went on, how it was done, and whether it did actually, in your opinion, have any effect on the outcome?
It was a complete fabrication. Quite sure I could say that positively because I was in the midst of it, and it was media speculation. There were two things: media speculation. Of course, they always like to pick the president's cabinet before the campaign is over, and so they speculated that Dulles would be Secretary of State and this and that. There was a lot of that. The second one is interesting in the light of history. Came out of California, that Ronald Reagan and George Murphy were bitterly opposed to Dewey, and they fostered this story. The fact of the matter is that many of those stories came from California, but this was the beginning of Reagan's interest in national politics. And it's hard to remember the feeling of conservative Republicans that Dewey was a terrible candidate, that he was a me-tooer, and that he believed in internationalism and bipartisan foreign policy. That was anathema to the very conservative Republicans who felt that cooperating in any way with the New Deal, even in the foreign affairs field, was
almost treason. And so that those stories, I think I can say with accuracy, were fomented by his enemies within the Republican Party. And there was no move made by him to select his cabinet or to... I think some of the stories were that he had his cabinet members had their houses all picked out for them in Washington. And it was just political scuttlebutt.
Other questions? Paul Drexler.
When Dewey then was governor of New York, he promised that he'd clean up and open a New York political, very powerful political machine, the O'Connell brothers. You may remember that. I wonder if you have any background on that and why he suddenly, after a year in Albany, said, I made my peace with him.
Why he won?
He made his peace with them
after a year in Albany.
Can you repeat the question for us?
Why did Dewey attack Tammany?
Yeah.
Well, it was a Tammany kind of
right.
A,
yeah. And then after a year in Albany, made his peace with him.
Well, I have never heard anybody make that statement before. I think that he had to deal with the legislature and compromise the way presidents and governors have to do if they don't control the legislature. And to that extent, I would say that there were some compromises in legislation. But as far as compromising with, you might say, the Tammany Hall element in the Democratic Party, I never could see any signs of that. I don't. Maybe you have some instances that would refresh my recollection.
That
right?
The machine is still in existence today.
Oh, yeah. Well, he couldn't destroy it. No, that's true.
Any other questions? Yes.
You mentioned polls earlier. Do you rely on polls as much then as the people seem to do today, or looking at it as
Dewey personally did. He was a great friend of George Gallup, and that was the leading. Gallup was the leading pollster in those years, and he had a personal friendship with Gallup, and he relied on Gallup's judgment for what the political sentiment in the country was. I would have to say that the rest of us in the management group didn't have that faith in the polls. They were not really as well developed at that time as they are now, and we preferred to rely on the reports of the Republican leaders and reporters from the various states, and that was the way we made our calculations. But Dewey had great faith in the polls.
Any other questions? Yes, Howard?
Would you tell what you know about the controversy in the 52 Republican convention between Taft and Eisenhower over a block of delegates that might have made the difference between Taft getting the nomination? They were disqualified. It seemed like the whole quarrel hinged on that block of delegates.
In 1952. Well, if that's not out of order, is that because it doesn't... Well, Dewey was a part of that, as a matter of fact, so I think it's perfect. If we have time to do it. This was the so-called Texas Steel. That's what you're referring to, I'm sure. And I'm writing my memoirs, and if you'll buy copies of it eventually, I'll have it in detail. If I can sum it up in about a minute, the fight centered in Texas. It was very the convention was very close between Taft and Eisenhower, and we in the Eisenhower group needed those Texas votes in order to get the nomination. Taft took the position in the Texas caucuses and the local precinct elections for delegates, that only those people who had voted Republican 4 years before were eligible to vote in the Republican Party in 52. We took the position, and Eisenhower forces, that anyone who declared in good faith swore to it that they were going to vote Republican in 52 was eligible to help select the delegates to the Republican convention. The Taft formula would have meant that the Republicans could never win in Texas because it was then a heavily Democratic state, and we thought that was wrong. And so I devised and we got the convention to declare that when there was a contest, like Texas, between two delegations, that the people who were involved couldn't vote on the question of whether or not they should be permanently seated at the convention. We called it the Fair Play Amendment. And we said that only the delegates from the states where there was no contest should vote on the question, and that the local people in Texas, if the Taft delegation was preliminarily put on the rolls of the convention, they couldn't vote on whether or not they themselves should be permanently put on the rolls. And that was the big fight, and we won that fight. That was the first television convention. It was in 52, and we dramatized this issue on the TV, and the Fair Play Amendment was adopted, and so the Taft delegates lost out in Texas, and there were two other states, Georgia and Louisiana, and that made the difference.
At the end of each one of these sessions, we always ask, could you isolate one or two strengths and one or two weaknesses of Dewey? The candidate?
Well, Dewey's intellect was his main asset. He was a brilliant student of foreign of public affairs, and had an analytical mind that was remarkable. And he had proved as governor of New York that he could administer a complex state's affairs. Those were his real abilities. I guess you'd say that his weaknesses were first this quirk in his makeup that he, as we put it a few minutes ago, he couldn't suffer fools gladly. He was his own worst enemy oftentimes in not being politic or not being diplomatic in conversations that he had with people who considered themselves his equal. And that was a real handicap to him. And I believe that was, the reason I was hesitating was as to whether his isolationist background in the early days was a factor in the final analysis. I don't know. But he did change his point of view so completely on that subject, which was highlighted during the 40s, of course, during the war period, that I think there were always some people, like Wendell Willkie is the best example, who were suspicious of the sincerity of the views that he did express when he was strongly internationalist in his point of view.
Some of you who may not have been close to our Miller Center commissions may not know that, as others in the room do know, that General Brownell has made the selection of chairman of commissions almost impossible. He chaired our Commission on Presidential Disability in the 25th Amendment. We've been looking for another Brownell, and we've not found one. We've found some very good people. Those of you who've heard him today may well say in the future, where is the next Herbert Brownell? We thank him very much for being here.